We are back. Welcome to IPIN's Property Industry Insights. This is your host, Eric Jafari. I'm here for podcast number two. The return of liquidity, is it here to stay? I've got with me again, Merzak Kadur, head of hospitality and leisure over at Clydesdale Bank, Ed Horn Smith, who's a director at Ark & Co. And we've got Andrew Fowler again from Union Hanover Securities. All right, let's get to the news before we get to the news. I just picked up the Wall Street Journal today, and one of the headlines is Germany rejects EU proposal on banks. Marzak, since you work for a bank, I'm going to pick on you. What exactly does this mean? What is going on?
Basically, the EU has, in its wisdom, decided to go for one regulatory authority to regulate the entire Eurozone banking sector. And surprisingly, this was resisted, obviously, by Germany. It certainly is resisted by the UK. The reason why the UK is resisting it is that it's quite simple. The former Financial Services Authority has been disbanded and replaced by two authorities, the PRA, the Prudential Regulatory Authority, and the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority. The first one, the PRA, is the one that makes sure that the banks are solvent, the balance sheets are well built, and they have enough reserves. The second one, the Financial Conduct Authority, controls the conduct of the banks and the bankers, basically, make sure that they are playing by the rule book. The new authority in the EU, there's been very little detail in terms of what the remit will extend to, but one thing is for sure, they were looking to increase the buffer required by either the UK regulator or the German regulator. So it's basically placing more pressure on the banking sector to increase the buffer, to increase the reserves, and therefore, to my mind, restrict lending.
Okay. So Germany's rejected it. Why?
It's interesting, actually, because I would imagine they would have been party to the original plans of having one regulatory authority. I think they must have thought long and hard. There is still recession in the Eurozone at the moment. Probably a year ago, a year and a half ago, they would have encouraged something like this. Mm. At the moment, the economy has shown some early shoots of recovery. We don't see that in Europe at the moment. And interestingly, we don't see it from someone like Germany. So they're probably thinking the last thing we want to do is to stifle the growth of lending.
Interesting. Okay. Well, things have been slow and cautious since the Lehman crash. The European crisis hasn't been fully resolved. You got the majority of the global economy that still remains a bit stagnant. Unemployment still remains high. And yet we see a lot of confidence in the capital and the debt markets. The FTSE and the Dow and the Nasdaq have all performed very well over the course of the last few years. And then you have a lot of big banks all of a sudden that are coming back into the market. You've got a lot of new entrants. What has caused confidence to return back to the debt markets?
I think the point that we discussed earlier, the banks have been going through hibernation, a lot of soul searching for the past 5 years or so. This allowed them to do one of two things, work out all the troublesome loans that they've had. Worked out a cost-cutting exercise, restructure. I cannot think of a single bank in the UK that did not go through a restructure in one shape or another. And that would have meant for some shedding a lot of staff, losing a lot of employees. For others, it's just basically a brand new proposition. They've changed direction and decided not to play in the investment market as much as they did, for instance. Regulation also, which is the point we discussed earlier, has made it very prohibitive to be a key player in the investment market. They're trying to separate and put a firewall between so-called casino lending, investment market, and the traditional retail stroke commercial banking lending.
So like Glass-Steagall in the States.
Correct. And I think there's been a lot of push to instill that firewall, and banking sector and bankers have been under the spotlight for a long, long time. And confidence is back because I think depending on the size of the organization you are as a lender, you would have had time to work out the issues and rebuild two things, both the balance sheet and the confidence of your employees. Something that's often not mentioned in the press is in the banking sector, it's been hammered so much that the confidence of the staff isn't what it used to be, which lends to deals taking a long time to materialize. If you look at the flow of transactions pre-Lehman, you could conclude the deal in 6 weeks, on average 7 weeks. It takes 3 months or more now, in some cases 6 months, to conclude the deal because people are checking and double-checking and triple-checking. It became far more process-led than it ever was before. And so there is liquidity now. What is interesting, in addition to the traditional lenders, is that the shadow lenders, the new platforms that sprung up, private equity, hedge funds, etc., or the challenger banks, have created quite a momentum in the last 18 months.
When you guys say shadow lending, you're referring to non-banks getting into...
Non-traditional bankers, exactly. Mm. And there's activity there.
So, Ed, I know you work with a lot of these shadow banks. Mm. Do you want to talk to us about what's happened over the course of the last 12 months and why some of these players have entered the market?
Sure. I think first of all, when we talk about liquidity in the market, I completely agree. If we look at it over the last 4 years, I think it would be fair to say there's more liquidity in the last 9 months than there has been for a long, long time. Where that liquidity is available, I still think is very limited.
Okay.
So we're not talking about the UK, and we're not talking about, you know, perhaps the clients that had access to liquidity prior to Lehman's. Okay, I think we're talking about a number of lenders that have come into the market, as previously said, particularly private equity lenders, replacing perhaps the development lenders or the high street lenders that aren't in the market but were in the market. There's been a real gap. They're looking to invest their money into London developments, perhaps. They're looking to invest their money into golden postcodes. They're looking to lend to good developers with a good track record, a good balance sheet, and, you know, good credit scores. So I think there is a huge amount of liquidity at the moment. I do think it's only available to the cream of the crop, if you like.
This actually feeds somewhat into the previous conversation we had to do with kind of the rich getting rich and the poor getting poor. I mean, it sounds like as long as you don't need the money, that's when they'll throw the money at you.
However, I would say, I think your point is interesting, and the point that you raise now, Eric, is also interesting. It doesn't mean that if you belong to the top 1%, that you're definitely credit worthy. If I just remind ourselves, as a lender, there are three tenets that you always abide by. They're called the three C's: character, capacity, and collateral. The first one, character. Is this customer, or how willing is this customer to repay the money? What's his track record or her track record in paying other lenders? And how honest and reliable are they? The second C is capacity. Has the customer got the financial ability to repay us? There is something called asset rich, and there is something called liquid rich. We must not forget the distinction here. The third one is collateral. If it all fails, is the asset good enough? You could be a top 1% customer and buy a dog of an asset elsewhere. That's not going to translate into a recoverable asset for a lender. We must always remember that. So the difference between asset rich and cash rich, I can tell you, as part of the work that I do, there are instances where you look at someone on an asset and statement, a statement liability sheet, they look very, very wealthy. When you dig deeper, there's very little by way of cash.
Andrew, I noticed you are obviously spearheading a series of hotel developments across the UK. And on one note, Ed's mentioned that really the lenders that he's working with are focusing predominantly on London. On the same note, I would say that is with a focus predominantly on residential.
Yeah.
You're doing some projects in places like Edinburgh, Portsmouth, Aberdeen, and whereas perhaps a year ago you didn't have lenders, now it seems like liquidity's come back. What have you seen?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking to, at the moment, refinance a project in Liverpool, which is largely overdeveloped, and people would think you're mad going into Liverpool and in a lot of asset classes at the moment. But there is an appetite of some of what we would call the high street banks to lend. Probably not good to mention them in the exact loan-to-cost rates, but, I mean, we're seeing 65% loan-to-cost on senior debt, and once the asset is trading, there's even more of an appetite to lend on these properties. I would say 6 months ago, if we had mentioned anything outside London, people would have closed the door. Mm. But on the basis that, particularly on a multi-asset portfolio, if you have maybe a couple of assets in London and a couple of assets outside of London, they're certainly looking to do it. I mean, the banks now, the traditional banks, I think, have hit some of their targets on getting back some of the debt. If you look at the De Montfort report for 2013, which is, you know, a globally recognised barometer of the more traditional lending institutions. Whilst, as the guys correctly said, there's a lot more different types of institutions coming into the market to lend, the traditional banks are starting to lend again as well. And we've seen the first, they've all contracted on their lending portfolios since Lehman. But for the first time in 2013, we've seen them coming back into the market, and for the first time outside of London as well.
Majdik, maybe you could help us with this. There's been a lot of conversation and talk about how the Basel III rules having been pushed back from 2014 to 2019 is what has opened up the liquidity for the real estate industry. Mm-hmm. Now, most of our listeners don't know what Basel III is, mm-hmm. and maybe if you could give us a little bit of background as to what exactly is this, mm-hmm. and why does it matter?
Okay, Basel III is often referred to as Solvency II as well, so it followed Solvency I, which was Basel II. And it's basically the clue is in the name there. They look at how solvent is a lending institution in the case of trouble. So when the chips are down, have you got enough money? Have you got enough of a buffer to sustain your losses? And it's interesting the way Basel has moved in the last 4 years. Initially, post-Lehman, there was panic, there was chaos, understandably so, and they were talking about going all the way to 11% of the capital that you lend, you must hold as reserve.
What was it before?
Take your pick, depending which type of organization and whether you used capital A or capital B. Some institutions ended up having 5%, others having 7%. I'll contrast this. There's one UK-based international bank that had a 7%. There was another UK-based UK bank that had a 5%. So there was varying degrees, and they wanted to standardize the percentage.
So 11% would mean that me as a bank, I would have to set aside double the amount of money almost than what I did prior and still operate.
And still operate solvently. Now, on one end of a spectrum, you'll understand that, and you will say, okay, because post-Lehman, quite clearly, when Lehman happened, there wasn't that option to stand the losses or to cover their liabilities. But when you look at the detail, Basel digs in deeper. As a lending institution at the moment, every lending institution uses what's known as a Basel model. That's a credit risk rating model. Similar to you and I applying for a credit card, we get given a score, and that score determines the limit. Similar to you and I applying for a residential mortgage, and whether we will get 60% or LTV or 3% margin depends on how we score. Well, a commercial or a business transaction gets scored in the same way under Basel. If I give you an example, if you were to buy a hotel or residential mortgage, but let's pick a hotel. If you buy a hotel and you score it under a Basel model, depending on where that asset sits within the risk scale, and it goes from 1 to 23, if you pick the mid number as 13, that's an acceptable risk. So you'll get better pricing for that. And you put less capital aside for that. The credit score, 13, probably for every £1 you lend, let's say you put 17 pence aside. If you go to risk 15 and above, it increases exponentially. For every £1 you put aside, you may have to put 45 pence aside.
And so the interest rate to the developer or the borrower
will be higher. Absolutely, because you're priced for risk as a lender. So Basel is there in theory, and it should be in practice, to ensure that an institution is solvent in times of crisis. So the governments don't have to do a bailout as they did in one or two banks here in the UK.
Okay, so you've explained Basel. Now, apparently, according to Basel III, the banks had to set aside a certain... They were required to set aside this certain minimum requirement by 2014.
Correct.
Now it's been pushed off to 2019.
Yeah, and that's common sense. Okay. That's common sense.
Well, why was it pushed off?
Well, first of all, it was pushed down because I think the various regulators and the various heads of government assumed that the cycle that we're in at the moment was going to be short-lived. There were all sorts of consensus that we're going to come out of this 2 years ago, 3 years ago, pick a number. And in reality, we are just about crawling our way out
here.
So they
didn't want to put the banks right
back in. They did not want the lending to be restricted again, because lending is crucial to the economy.
Okay. So let me ask you, I'm going to ask you the obvious question. So banks now all of a sudden have free money, more available money,
yeah,
which means that they're going to start lending again. But if we know that these restrictions are going to be implemented in 2019, wouldn't that mean that come 2, 3, 4 years from now, if they know they've got to increase their reserves again, that lending will get tightened again?
To be honest with you, the majority of the banks, and there's been a solvency test that was carried out on the UK banks, the majority of them are there or thereabout. You may have heard recently that the PRA has asked the banks to come up with 13.4 billion. Recently,
and PRA, they named
The Prudential Regulatory Authority.
Okay.
And 13.4 billion. If you look at it as a number, you think that's high. That's not high at all. That's spread across three or four major banks in the UK. 2 years ago, they would have asked them to come up with something like 80 or 90 billion, maybe more. So they had time now to rebuild their balance sheets. And a lot of them have been asked to sell what's non-core. They've been disposed of the insurance.
Non-core
assets, for example, RBS sold an insurance company. Lloyds has sold one or two other companies. And that money goes into their balance sheets. They're not giving them back to their shareholders. They are reinforcing their balance sheets. To answer your question, between now and 2019, the balance sheets are well built.
So from your perspective, this liquidity, this emergence of liquidity from the banking side is back.
Is back.
And it's here to stay for the foreseeable future.
I think unless there is a major geopolitical event that will prevent that from happening, the answer is yes. There's something as well that we didn't mention, which is the funding for lending. I mean, the government has pumped so much cash into the system here in the UK. And so did also the European Bank, Central Bank. There is so much liquidity, and it's at a cost that historically has never been so low. And you're seeing that filtered through either the residential market or even the commercial market.
Ed, okay, I'm going to ask you the obvious question. If the banks are back and lending again, why would someone go to a shadow bank to borrow? Why are some of your borrowers coming to you and saying, hey, listen, get me a loan? And why would you? What are the shadow banks providing that the high street banks aren't?
I think that's a really good question, Eric. And look, I think there have been specific funds and lenders that have come into the market to cover specific gaps in the market. So, you know, if we look at commercial, there's lenders in the market at the moment, investment lenders, individuals and investment banks, even Goldman Sachs, for instance, have funds in place for commercial loans. And they were set up specifically to target high loan to values coming towards an end on double A commercial long leased properties, say in the city, so very high value that might have been financed in 2007 at 80% of value, and they're coming for renewal. The bank that made that loan, perhaps an Irish bank, doesn't want to renew.
Always pick on the Irish.
And there is a gap in the market, which has now been filled, of lenders that are looking to target those exact assets to lend on.
All right. So just using that example, based on what you've just said, one of the benefits as to why a borrower would go to a shadow bank over a high street bank is because perhaps a higher loan to value?
Yeah, the gearing levels. I think everyone will agree that perhaps, some lenders, and not all lenders, I mean, lending's nothing like it was, prior to the financial crisis, but the lenders that are in the market, once bitten, twice as shy, I suppose, have a view of being relatively conservative, massively conservative too, prior to the financial crisis, but still relatively conservative. And when you're talking about big assets, £100 million asset, and you can only get gearing levels of 55, maybe 60%, it still leaves a huge gap. Okay.
And so this is where you think the shadow banks have been effective in accommodating
the gap. Yeah. I mean, the flavor of last year or the year before, I think, was mezzanine lending. Okay. So junior debt. Right.
So for the listeners, mezzanine lending is the loan that sits behind the senior debt loan.
Yeah, correct. So it's kind of a top-up loan, if you like. So the senior debt might lend to 60%, as they still are today. And, last year and the year before, we saw an influx of mezzanine lenders, so junior lenders, that would fill maybe a 20, maybe a 30% gap at a much higher coupon. So,
a lot higher
double-digit interest rate.
So if I have a property that's worth £10 million, I go to the bank, they give me six million pounds, and then I would go to mezzanine lender A, and he would give me another £2-3 million, and then I have to come up with the balance myself.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think that would be one area. The other area is development lending, and where that's been limited to, you know, a handful of lenders on the high street, maybe less, two fingers. There's been a real gap in that market, and that's been filled again in previous years by mezzanine lenders that would lend 20%. This year, what we've seen in the last 9 months is a real influx of lenders that want to lend the full amount. Okay, and they'll gear to perhaps 90% of cost, 70% of end value, and it makes the process a lot quicker for the client, because you don't need intercredit deeds or two sets of solicitors. You can try.
Right, so we'll just stop right there. So one of the benefits. So what you're saying is that instead of me going to Bank A, getting a senior debt loan, then going to the mezzanine and getting a separate loan for the top up. Mm-hmm. You're saying that at this year, a lot of the shadow banks are saying, we'll just give you one loan.
Yeah.
And you explained the intercredit. Could you just explain what an intercredit agreement is to the listeners?
Yeah, it's a deed of priority, between the primary lender and the secondary lender, an agreement that says your security ends at 60%, our security ends at 90%. It's just a legal document
that outlines the relationship between the two borrowers.
Yeah, correct.
And that can take time and money.
It can take time. I mean, the key thing I think is time. You know, if I have a client and they're looking to acquire a good asset, there's probably three or four other people looking to acquire that asset, and if they can move quickly. And can complete quickly, agree terms quickly. You know, with most of the private lenders, so the shadow lenders that I work with, you know, they can transact in 3-4 days, okay? Mm. And they can transact with gearing up to, 95%, okay, of the cost. So this costs my client much more in terms of interest, but... You know, I think a savvy investor certainly in the London market at the moment is more focused on return on equity than so what they're putting into the development or investment and what they're getting out of it, as opposed to what coupon they're paying per year.
I mean, Andrew, from your perspective, you're a developer. Why would you go to when do you go to high street banks and when do you go to the shadow banks?
Well, I think when you're going the more traditional route and you're working with an institutional level covenant or a slightly less than an institutional level covenant in your development at PC, then you're talking to the more traditional lenders.
Okay, just hold on there. PC, what does that mean?
Practical completion. So when we're developing, the building is practically complete is when it's finished. And normally...
An institutional covenant? What are you referring to?
We're talking that in an ideal world, the banks will give you an investment finance on the basis that maybe you're putting a bank or an insurance company or a very large corporation into your building that's going to pay the rent on time every month. Obviously, the lesser the strength of that tenant, the lesser the desire the bank will have to give you the money to hold that investment or to refinance that investment. And it's when you start to cross those grey lines is when you start to look to the shadow lenders, as you call it.
Mm. So if something is very simple and it's plain vanilla, then you go to a high street bank. And if it's got it's a little bit more complicated, you would go to a shadow lender.
I think that's a way of summarizing it.
Eric, if I can just come in there, I think I agree with the comments that were raised there. But I think the reason why these so-called alternative lenders and shadow lenders have sprung up, and there are so many of them at the moment in the UK, is the point that we were talking about earlier. They realized that the banks were trying to understand or deal with the issues of the past and hadn't worked out the opportunities of the future. So these guys came in, and they were the opportunities of the future. So they came in with a lot of capital. They don't have Basel restrictions, and they understood that the banks have plateaued. They have maxed. Pick any bank and pick any sector. Until the post-Lehman, banks didn't have restrictions on caps on each sector. It's about spreading the risks. At the moment, if you're a lender, you have X percent relative to the overall lending book that you can lend on hospitality. The same on resi, the same on agriculture, the same in manufacturing, etc., etc. You spread the risk. You do not put all your money, unless you're a specifically agri bank, or specifically resi banking.
Well, okay, this is an interesting point. What happens if all the other sectors are performing poorly, and it just so happens that, let's say, resi or hotels are performing very well? Does that mean your hands are tied?
Well, your hands are tied in a sense that it doesn't mean that you can increase the cap. I mean, you can go back to your shareholders or your company and say, look, this sector is doing very well. Can we increase it? But aren't you increasing the risk, the whole idea of capping it at a certain level? The idea is that the overall book increases. If the overall lending book increases, your percentage relative to that book increases as well.
Yeah.
And it's the point that you raise, and that's happening at the moment with all the lenders. There are certain sectors that are cyclical in nature, and pick hospitality, for example. It's highly cyclical and volatile. And historically, a lot of the lenders didn't have specific sector people lending to that sector. They would have had a property lender lending on a hotel. I mean, the documentation is wrong, the security probably is wrong, the risk analysis is wrong, etc. I can go on. And it ends up at some stage being in a distressed portfolio because it was transacted wrong. And that's what stopped the banks.
Explain it. Why would a bank do that? Why would a bank take a non-expert to oversee the loan of a £100 million hotel, or even £20 million hotel for that matter?
Well, some of them, probably I would think of one organization, maybe two historically in the UK that had dedicated...
I'm not going to name any names.
I won't name that had dedicated sector-specific people lending to it. Historically, to answer your question, is that take 10 bankers from any bank, 8 of them will be property lenders. And hotels are a trading business. They're not a property play. If somebody is an investor, goes into them as a property play, they are still in trouble. It's a trading business. Understanding the cash flow and understanding how the dynamics of that cash flow operate is key to lending to the sector.
Interesting. Okay. Well, talk to me about what are banks thinking these days? What is it that, because you hear a lot about how liquidity is back, but then yet I speak to a lot of borrowers and they're still complaining because they can't get any money.
Okay. The first thing I'd say on this is that banks will not exist. They will cease to exist if they don't lend. So they will lend. I think the point was made earlier, they're not lending to the levels they were before Lehman's, but we're not in that world either. So things have changed. But they are still lending. So who do they want ideally? They want someone, as I described earlier, with the 3 C's, that has the character, the capacity, and the collateral, right? Someone that they know can repay them back. Anybody that has been a borrower in the last 4 or 5 years and has sustained and maybe grown throughout the last 4 or 5 years and hasn't gone under will be, to my mind, somebody that fits in the character and the capacity. Because we've never witnessed such a volatile and difficult trading environment as the last 4 or 5 years. So you will argue that somebody who's good enough, who's repaid his loan on time, has been operating, hasn't gone under, is good enough to lend to. That's as a general comment. But the banks would like to understand the business proposition. If I were to tell you that out of 10, pre-Lehman, out of 10 propositions that I got, they weren't what I would describe business plans. People would send me a couple of pieces of paper, and that's the outline of the business. And they failed to do what is a cardinal sin. Tell me how much you want. Tell me why you want it. Tell me why I should lend to you. And am I likely to be repaid? And all of this will form the risk analysis or that I carry out as a banker. And it's not just financial. So there's a lot of non-financial risk analysis that gets carried out. People are still not understanding. They turn up to a lender, senior lender, with a couple of pages, and they think it's a business plan. I would not advise that process at all. If you want to go to a senior lender, first of all, it's about relationship banking. Do you have a track record with that bank? If you don't, do you know someone who has that could facilitate an introduction? That's number one. If you knew them very well, they know you. They will have no reason not to lend to you unless you're not a good lend. If you don't know them, then make sure someone introduces you. An accountant will be a good introduction, or a lawyer that knows the institution.
Or a broker.
Absolutely, that knows the institution. And they would say, listen, I know this guy, and I facilitate the introduction. Let those people know you via somebody else. And please present them with a business plan. The business plan is a business plan. It needs to tell them what the concept is. It needs to tell them why they should lend to you. We don't get that.
Actually, you've been working on this a lot, Andrew, lately. What type of, when you're going to the bank, what exactly are you providing them with?
Well, I mean, as you said, I mean, the devil is in the detail. They want to see everything, warts, potential warts and all. You know, they want to see some sensitivity analysis on it. What's going to happen if this if there is another dip? What's going to happen if X, Y, and Z? So you've thought through the the entire process, and you've also prepared for the potential hurdles that are ahead, because as we've seen in the past, there can be some major hurdles ahead and there will be further hurdles in the future. So the devil is in the detail, and once you present that to the banks, then they're...
What's typically comprised in when you put together a bank packet, what is inside the bank packet?
Well, they want to see everything from the sort of the title, the property side, so everything to do with the title, whether it's a freehold, whether it's a leasehold, any restrictions on that. They're going to want to see who the development team is. Do they have a track record? And the full professional team, right, from, you know, architects, engineers, the construction management, the property management, the entire team. They're going to look through everything with a fine-tooth comb. You know, what is their delivery track record? And in particular, how has that team dealt with problems in the past? Because in development, everybody's going to have problems, and it's how your ability to deal with those problems and deliver a project on time. So I think it really comes down to track record.
Ed, on this note, I mean, do the shadow banks look for the same things, or is it a different set of criteria?
I think it really depends on the loan. You know, if it's a bridge loan, the loan might be a lot more on the asset than the individual. I think if there's any element of development, then it's very much focused on track record. You've got to remember, you know, the shadow banks, as we're calling them, these aren't, you know, what I would call old school private equity funds that I became familiar with maybe 4 years ago, you know, ran by ex kind of New York Goldman Sachs guys. You know, these are funds that were specifically set up to lend into the everyday property market, the London property market. You know, these are ran by ex high street bank professionals that have been in the market and know it well and have done for 20, 25 years. You know, their approach is exactly the same as it was when they left their high street bank 3-4 years ago because they weren't lending any money. So the due diligence process and everything else is similar. They can work through it a lot quicker because they're a smaller team, and they're not regulated, and they only focus on what they feel is important prior to lending their money.
I think as well to add to that is that they have more of an ability to be creative and come up with new lending products. I mean, we talked about the facilities you said. I mean, we call it a stretched senior facility where, you know, you go to the traditional banks, you'll get 65% loan to cost, but then you're going to your mezz guys, and these guys have the ability to roll it all into one, make it a one-stop shop. It's like if you were buying a car and you had to go to three different places to piece your car together, you're certainly going to pay a little bit of a premium and go to somebody that gives you your car ready to rock and roll. And I think these guys are being able to provide that, and that's what people are looking for.
And I think just to kind of, as an add-on with that, it's been really interesting. I think every lender that's been in that space, they might have just done, for instance, bridge loans. In the last year, you know, they've become a lot more creative. Now they don't just do bridge loans; they do mezzanine loans, they do stretch senior loans, they do development loans. They've really grown as a consequence of really just tailoring to their clients' needs.
All right, are you guys seeing any insurance companies enter the lending game? Yes, no.
We had a lot of talk about insurance companies. They're not. One or two of them are. And they're looking for a specific type of deal. They're looking, first of all, for a large ticket transaction. Okay. They want it to be either London-specific or in a very, very good outside London location. They're looking for a decent covenant, as we discussed earlier.
Example, I've got a building. I need to lease it to the government or
correct.
To a big, big...
Large group. Corporation, double A rated.
35-year lease.
Absolutely. They want for a sweet deal. They're looking for an annuity.
They don't want the risk.
They do not want the risk. On the risk scale, they're not risk takers at all. There was talk a while back that under Basel III, it was making it more appealing to encourage them to come into the lending market. And we had all sorts of rumours that they were looking to set up lending platforms and hire people, but nothing has materialised since.
Why is that? Just they're slow to move? They have their own...
I think it's an interesting industry. I think they probably took a look at the banking sector and were worried in terms of what they let themselves into. If the so-called professionals got it so wrong, why wouldn't they get it wrong? And I think they felt that on a case-by-case situation, they will lend money. Some of them follow their own clients as well.
Some what?
They follow their own clients, their own customers. Right. So you've got a customer. If you're a US-based insurance giant and you've got an office in London and your customer wants to do a deal here, you'll do it for that customer and you'll have minimal staffing representation in the London office and you'll do it for them. But we haven't seen a lot of them lending.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought you hit the nail on the head in your first sentence. There's been a lot of talk of insurance companies coming into the market. I mean, maybe I'm just not seeing them.
We've met with a few and there has been conversation, but it hasn't gone past the cup of coffee. Mm. All right, what impact do you think the lending, now that there's a lot of talk that lending's back, what impact will it have on property values going forward? Do you think it will have an impact on property values?
Look, property transactions per se are a reflection of supply and demand. And supply and demand is not just to do with the availability of the property, but the availability of finance. My quick thinking would say, yes, it will have an impact. But there's been lack of funding in the past 4 years and values still went up.
What? How? Why?
Well, I've lived here for 27 years and I still find it quite interesting how the values in the UK rocket up compared to other European countries. It is difficult. The ownership, the UK concept and the mindset is about ownership, not about rental. If I contrast that with France, you know, people wouldn't think twice about not owning a property. They're happy to rent. In the UK, ownership is key, is part of the psyche, I think, of the British mentality. And for them, ownership is quite crucial. And the values go up all the time. It's also an island. There's lack of space, lack of development. It's a supply and demand dynamic. If you flood it with new developments, I would imagine it will have an impact on values.
Do you think that lending will have an impact on the hotel market?
Certainly. We're certain to see lending coming back into the market. I think that some markets in the UK are oversupplied in terms of hospitality. So I think the banks are going to be very cautious about how they lend. So, and I think that it's, as I said, liquidity is back, but liquidity is back with a magnifying glass. So as you said, it comes down to the due diligence, the business plan. If you can show the bank through that there's a need for a hospitality product in a certain location, the lending is there. It's not like it was 4 or 5 years ago where you can go charging into a location and just build a hotel, because a lot of these are oversupplied because of what happened back in those days.
Ed, what areas do you think it'll impact the residential market? And if so, what classes of residential will it impact?
I don't know what's going to happen in terms of prices. I certainly think, as you've already said, the liquidity is there for developers. The liquidity is there in a way that I haven't seen for 4 or 5 years. And I think because of that availability, especially the really leveraged availability for a good developer in a good location, I think you would expect to see a lot more development over the course of the next 2-3 years, which will increase the supply available. You know, what that will do to prices, I'm not sure. It's very hard to say, you know, because I think certainly in the areas that we typically work in, London, South East, and kind of golden postcodes, I suppose, everything's kind of done the opposite of what people predicted. So to say what's going to happen, I think, will be very difficult.
Okay. I guess the last question is, you know, what are your views on whether, you know, I've asked this before, but, and Merzik, I've asked this to you, but I'm asking the other guys, do you believe the liquidity is here to stay? Will the shadow banks be around a year or 2 years from now, and what will determine whether they stay or whether they go?
I mean, yeah. I certainly believe that liquidity will be here to stay, but it's here to stay in a different way. It's going to come back slowly and carefully. And when it is back, it's going to take a more meticulous approach to applying that liquidity. But I do believe that we're starting to see the green shoots of a more liquid market.
Yeah, I'm touching a piece of wood as I say this, Eric. I would share Andrew's view. I think it is here to stay. I think it's going to be strategic, smart lending. I think it's going to become more competitive through the shadow lenders. I think they're going to be competing price-wise with the development high street lenders in the market at the moment, because it's the positioning, I think, at the moment is relatively conservative when you look at what the loans are to the end values, and when you look at what the strong golden postcodes have done over the course of the last 4 years.
Hmm. All right. On that note, you know, a lot of what has been discussed today has been based on the fact that, yes, liquidity is back, but with a very heavy caveat, being that the banks and even the shadow banks are conservative. Will it ever go back to the way it was, the boom days? Will it ever go back? They always say that people have a very short memory. And in your opinion, could we be sitting here 5-10 years from now talking about the next crash? Because we forgot about the lessons that we learned from the last one.
I think I'd say no for a very good reason. This time regulation has played such a key role. Whilst previously, when Lehman happened, a lot of the regulators were asleep at the wheel. This time they have been, they come up to the fore, and we are so heavily regulated in this country and in Europe, in financial services market, quite rightly so as well. To the point where it made it for a while very difficult to even lend. On one hand, it's the stick and the carrot. We want you to lend. On another hand, we want you to build a buffer zone. So the two are contrasting remits. I think it will take a long time, maybe not in our working lifetime, before things go back to the old ways. Because now the reporting lines to the regulators are so intense. The focus is so high. I can't see them loosening that focus.
You guys, any comments?
No, I mean, I don't think that... Well, hopefully lightning won't strike twice, but you know, time will go by, and it'll be very strict for the foreseeable future. But I'm sure in the future something will come along that will tickle our psyche, whether it be, you know, a dot-com bubble or something new that financial institutions will want to get into, and that'll probably be the peak of the next cycle. But who knows what it's going to be?
I think I'd agree with both the guys. You know, I think personally, I think private lending, so non-regulated loans, are the future for the next 5-6 years at least.
For all sectors or residential?
For residential.
Okay.
I think the notorious ninja loans are gone and gone forever. I can't see them ever coming back. I think things were so out of control. I can't even see how they happened in the first place. But C would make the same mistake again. I think that would be a major screw up.
Yeah. Well, guys, thanks so much for joining me. It's been a fun time, and I look forward to having you guys again on the podcast. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Eric.